afternoon. You are tuned in to Juno Afternoon here for Tuesday, the 30th of May, the year 2017. I'm Jeff Bannon, your host for today. Today we'll be getting the details about the Parade Plus Art Show. Brendan Demery and M. McNaughton. Colette Costa will be here to talk about the Gold Town Classic Film Series. Steve Kostas will be here to highlight the upcoming total solar eclipse. And we'll talk with author Bill Spear about his new book on Jeeps. That Writer's Almanac, Burnout, Music and More today on Juno Afternoon. Well, the forecast for tonight, increasing clouds. Low temperatures around 48 degrees. Forecast for Wednesday, scattered showers, high near 60 degrees. Forecast for Thursday, rain likely, mostly before 4 p.m.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has asked the Pope to formally apologize for the Catholic Church's role in Canada's Indian residential school system. Native children across the country were forced to attend the schools, where many suffered abuse. More from Dan Karpinchuk.
His request to the Pope was one of the 94 recommendations that came out of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. From the mid-1800s to the late 1900s, about 150,000 Native children were forced to attend the residential schools. They were designed to assimilate Native children into white culture. But thousands were physically, sexually, or emotionally abused. About 6,000 died. The schools were funded by the government and run by churches. Formal apologies have already been made by the United, Anglican, and Presbyterian churches, but there's been no formal apology from the Vatican. In 2009, Pope Benedict expressed sorrow for the deplorable conduct of some of the members of his church for their treatment of indigenous children. But the Truth and Reconciliation Commission said that did not go far enough. Trudeau was optimistic after his private meeting with Pope Francis.
He reminded me that his entire life has been dedicated to supporting marginalized people in the world, fighting for them, and that he looked forward to working with me and with the Canadian bishops to figure out a path forward together.
The National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations, Perry Bellegarde, says he's hopeful the Pope will come through with a formal apology. But at least one critic, Romeo Saganash, a residential school survivor and a member of the Canadian Parliament, called Trudeau's visit a public relations stunt that would do nothing to help Indigenous communities in Canada. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Canada's Indigenous rights movement and artist Alicia Keys are the joint recipients of this year's Amnesty International Ambassador of Conscience Award. A group of Native activists and Keys were honored over the weekend in Montreal, Canada. Keys, who was praised for using her talents to inspire others and further the cause of human rights, acknowledged Indigenous people in her acceptance speech.
I wonder, why are Native people the most oppressed? The ones who have been here the longest, the ones that built the whole country with sweat and tears and still have to fight for their dignity. Why are they still fighting to be seen? Why are we still fighting to be seen, to be heard, to be respected, to be free and equal?
The award recognizes human rights work, and it's the first time given to a Canadian recipient. According to Amnesty, activists from across Canada have fought to end discrimination and ensure the well-being of Indigenous communities. The Minneapolis Walker Art Center is postponing the opening of a sculpture garden, the Star Tribune reports, after Native people raised concerns about a gallows-like piece by a Los Angeles-based artist. Gallows executions in Minnesota in the 1800s included 38 Dakota people. Members of the Native community called the sculpture insensitive. This weekend's opening is delayed until June 10th in order for the center to meet with Native elders. A historical festival in South Dakota this weekend will give people a look at frontier life, as South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Elmbold reports.
Visitors to the park will get a look at Dakota Territory life in the mid-1800s, when the military facility came to life as Fort Wadsworth. It was renamed Fort Sisseton 3 years later. The entire weekend centers around work and activities performed at that time. That includes fiddle music, dance instruction, and a costume ball. Some of the instruction will center around Native American activities. Jerome Killsmall is scheduled to share a presentation on traditional Lakota songs and dances. A Lakota hoop dancer, Dallas Chief Eagle, will perform during the weekend as well. Fort Sisseton is located in northeast South Dakota, just west of the Lake Traverse Indian Reservation. I'm Gary Ellen Bold.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support by the Northwest Portland Area Indian Help Board.
Were you born from 1945 through 1965? People born during these years have the highest rates of hepatitis C, yet most don't know they are infected. Hepatitis C is the leading cause of liver cancer, but you can do something about it. Talk to your doctor about getting tested. It could save your life. Visit www.cdc.gov/nomorehepatitis.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And 6 minutes past the hour, you are tuned into Juneau Afternoon. Our first guests are here to talk about Pride Month, which is coming up next month. Brandon Demery and M.K. McNaughton, thank you for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff.
So, June 5th is the day that the Marines are going to proclaim it.
Yeah, that's correct. I think this is the third year in a row now that our mayor will proclaim June Pride Month. That will take place next month on June 5th at Assembly Chambers.
So tell me, what is Pride Month?
Pride Month is a month that is recognized internationally or nationally here in the month of June. And most international Pride festivities occur around this time. Here in Juneau, this is our fourth well-organized Pride Week. This year, Pride Month kicks off with the art exhibition that MK curated and we'll talk about today. But we have several events. On June 10th, we have our annual pub crawl. It'll be downtown. Info can be found on sigla.org or on Facebook. The second event is the Pride Picnic. It'll be our 31st annual Pride Picnic at Shelter Number 2 over at Sandy Beach. That's on the 11th from 11 a.m. until 4 p.m. In the midweek, on Wednesday, we have Pride Kickball at Savico Park, Shelter Number 4 or Field Number 4. And then our big event, which will take place on Saturday, June 17th, that's Glitz Drag Show at Centennial Hall at 7 p.m. Tickets still on sale at sigla.org for general seating and high top seating. And we'll round it off with a bonfire, kind of hair of the dog, take it easy Sunday, a late afternoon, probably on North Douglas. Weather dependent. As we draw near, we'll have exact location, but that'll start around 4 or 5 in the afternoon on Sunday the 18th.
And okay, you're curating an art show.
Yes.
About that.
A couple months or two ago, James Hoagland approached me and asked if I would be willing to curate, and I'm very happy to do it. So I have another show myself in Anchorage. I won't be at the opening, but I thought I could contribute in this way and support Sigla and we decided that anyone could enter. The theme needed to be pride related in some way. So gay, lesbian, bi, transgender, and
allies.
It could be, it doesn't have to be somebody who's gay who submits an art piece. And we got a great response and a really diverse group. There are currently 15 artists, 14 pieces. And there's one more, maybe, that I'm hoping will submit a piece. And they have a wide variety of materials, embroidery, collage, large installation pieces, photos printed on metal, encaustic painting, which is hot wax painting, digital drawing, pastel, acrylic, several poems, a great photo series I can't wait to see, pottery, and then some memorabilia from the past, T-shirt from the first queer march on Washington, D.C., and also a scrapbook of some Juneau history. And it's been fascinating to talk to people as they submit some. The age range is like 17 to 70, and some really experienced artists and some brand new or people who've never shared their work. So there's both the combination of some fear of sharing your story or sharing your art. So
and having the pride to display it.
Right.
Yeah.
And so it's been great. I'm totally happy in the role of supporting people in both. I like to share personal, difficult and happy things. Mm-hmm. Pride can be both. And also just sharing your art. I think it's scary for artists when they haven't done it before. So I'm really excited about it. I'm starting to hang the show a little bit tonight and tomorrow night, and it will be open on Friday at 4:30 at the Jack.
So what was your job as curator? Just look for the pieces, put them up on the wall and turn in
find order. The artists, make sure they turn things in, and hang it all up. I'm going to make labels that for the artists, and they print out their own statement. If they want to say something that goes with the piece or not, they can do that. Some people don't want that with their art, and sometimes it's helpful. So,
how many of the pieces will be available for sale?
That's a great question. About half of the pieces will be for
awesome.
Sale.
Yeah. Great.
Yeah.
And that opens when?
It opens this Friday.
First Friday.
The first Friday, which is the 4th, is that right?
Second.
The second? First Friday, the 2nd.
Yep.
This Friday at the Jack, 4:30 p.m.
What was your overall perception of the pieces?
I actually haven't seen the real pieces yet. They're dropping them off today and tomorrow. So I've seen many photos, though, and had many descriptions. And I'm really impressed by both the diversity of mediums and I'm really excited by some of the themes. One woman has a photo series of herself as three different genders. Hmm. So she does a lot of setup to create those images, I think including shaving her head. So I can't wait to see them. I met with her and talked to her and have been coaching her through the process, but I haven't seen the finished work yet. And pottery pieces that are intriguing. I think there's one piece that might not be out of the kiln in time for Friday, so she's going to substitute something and then trade it out when the piece is finished. But photos, some of them are sort of abstract and some of them are very specific. The embroidery piece is three separate pieces stacked called Still By. Let me see, poems. I was really touched by the 17-year-old's piece. She has a poem and a collage, and I spent some time helping her figure out how to print things out to make them look professional. So versus a piece that Sue Ann Randall and Mia Lager made. They displayed in 2003. I haven't seen it. It's a large installation piece, and they're bringing it back out. And I love that. I love the history of supporting Pride for a long time, supporting it in 2003 and still supporting it.
And so it happens on the 2nd of June.
2nd of June, this Friday.
And the mayor does a proclamation on the 5th.
That is correct.
And I understand, we'll find out for sure, Goldtown Theater will be showing some more films.
Related to Pride?
I heard something.
Oh, good.
We'll find out.
I saw Colette out there in the green room, so I'm sure she can fill you in.
All right. Anything else you want to add before we?
No, there's just the show at the Jack. Siegel is so thankful to MK for curating and bringing all these Alaska artists together, along with their pieces, new and old. And the show runs all month.
Is this information on your website?
Yes, it is. Absolutely. Siegla.org. It's also on the Jack website and Facebook pages.
All right. Brandon and MK, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.
Here in this body, I am a woman to my soul. With hips, wrists, and belly that you try to control. But the more you constrain me with your laws across the land, the harder I will push back and the stronger I will stand. I'm a woman
and I have these rights.
We are women
and we have these rights.
We are human
and we have these rights.
Enough is enough. You try to divide us straight from ones who have the papers from the ones not born here. But we will not be taken with your hatred and spite. We see right. expression.
We have these rights
to our own body.
We have these rights
to make decisions.
We have these rights
to have our voice.
We have these rights
to join together.
We have these rights
to vote for choice.
Brand new from Emma's Revolution. It came out of town a few years ago. And in studio with me now is Colette Costa here to talk about Goldtown Nickelodeon Theater.
Per usual. You know, what's it been, 3 days? 5 days?
I can't count that high.
3 hours? Well, you got your shoes off. You can surely count to at least seven. My goodness. Got a toe thing. You got a toe situation, Jeff. It's all those clown shoes all these years.
Totally cool.
I think you have seven on one foot. You know, so there's this whole thing in town with this whole First Friday art exhibit, and they've been doing it for a little while, and we've practically never done one. So I thought, you know what it's time to do? Join the sinking ship. I mean, join the caravan, I guess. One of us. You know me, I'm a joiner. I'm a regular old-fashioned bandwagon jumper-oner. So we're gonna do a First Friday exhibit. Why not? There's nothing else going on. It's only summertime, and this friend of mine, Terry Gallant, who does paintings and drawings and whatnot, and she just contacted me and she said, you know, I've got all these paintings of these silver screen sirens, you know, Marilyn and Jane and the other Jane and Lauren and all these women who should only be known by their first names. And I was like, well, let's do it, because I'm also currently doing the Classic Cinema Collective Club thing. I need more C's in a row. I'm not sure why there's so many C's.
Colettes.
So many more Colettes. Colettes Collective. Colettes Collection of, anyway, calluses. So I thought, well, this would be a nice tie-in, because we're going to be having, so we're doing, for those of you who don't know, the Goldtown is now doing a classic film series. It's something I've been wanting to do for a long time, and there are just so many thousands of films that deserve to be seen again on the big screen. And so I started this a few months ago, and then she came to me with this, and I thought, well, this would be a good tie-in. So I'm currently under the gun to pick a movie for June with a silver screen siren. So I'm just going to throw this out there. If people have ideas. I listen to all ideas. I don't heed very many of them. For instance, my dad said, don't go to film school. So if you have an idea, send it to me at goldtowntheater@gmail. I do have it narrowed down to like four titles, though. Here's the thing, Jeff. June is the birthday of both Marilyn Monroe and Jane Russell, who are kind of siren-y. And they were in a movie together called Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, which I kind of wanted to show, but it's kind of a musical, and I don't know.
But it doesn't start with a C.
It does start two C cups, I can tell you that much. So weird. Actually, I'm pretty sure Jane was a very famous double D, now that I think about it. She was the Cross Your Heart bra woman for a long time. So I do have it narrowed down to a few wonderful titles. But I'll be making that announcement in a couple of days, what our new title is with our Silver Screen Siren. And on Friday, we will be debuting these works of Terry's. I think it's not very many. It's only maybe 8 or 9 works. Some are paintings, some are drawings, pencil drawings. And and she specialized in sirens and in, well, I can't remember what the other ones were. Vixens. That's why. Because she's got some, what's her name? Betty, I know. Ding dong. Her name
you're the film expert.
Yeah, she only made two movies. She made a lot of movies that people of a certain age weren't allowed to see, if you know what I mean. So that will be there all day Friday, and we'll have a little reception, as people do, Friday from about 4 to 6. Come in, have some cheese and wine with me, W-H-I-N-E, because, you know, you can't serve wine. Nod, nod, wink, wink. Check out the paintings. We'll have a wonderful slideshow going on, and you can learn more about our Classic Cinema Club. We have tons of things going on.
Give me a little bit more detail about this for the club.
So as you know, the Gold Town Theater is still 35mm compatible. So I wanted to continue that tradition that Lyle started when he opened the place back in 98. But they don't make new films on 35mm anymore. So your options become very limited very fast. But I'm also a total film junkie and movie nerd, and I have a great affection for films made prior to all films, but particularly older films made prior to 1960, and feel that they certainly deserve a lot more attention and deserve to be seen by a new generation. So, and I've been wanting to do this for a couple years, but, you know, they're not cheap. They're just as expensive as any new film, and I had to figure out a way to do it where I didn't lose money. So I put together basically a club, and I sold a very limited number of memberships. And the memberships entitled you to essentially free movies for the entire series. But it enabled me to pay for the series, so I didn't have to basically worry about losing money, quite frankly, because when you've been planning a movie for 3 months and then it's on the screen and it's 75 degrees out, I don't care if Roy Scheider himself shows up to tell you how awesome Jaws is. No one's going to be there to watch it. So that's the way Juno is. So I had to build some cushion in. But basically, the series was put together with the idea of it being an 8-film series. We'll take a couple summer months off for obvious reasons. And December is way too busy to do anything anyway. It's one classic film a month right now. And it's shown multiple times, either within a week or within the month, so that people have time to see it. It's clearly open to the public. It's regular film prices. You don't have to pay extra. I get as many as I can on 35mm, but even getting those is hard because what they used to do is they would have prints of, say, Casablanca, and they would rent, you know, loan them out to all these theaters, and they would wear out. As they would wear out, they would strike new prints. Well, they don't even do that anymore because there's not enough film to strike new prints. So a lot of these films are becoming archival, and they're only allowed to be shown at specific theaters or at museums, et cetera, et cetera. So the whole idea of going to see a movie on film is going to become less and less common as these copies that we have become more precious. And we're also losing a lot of films because, they didn't convert everything from 35 to VHS and certainly not to Blu-ray. So with every change in format, you lose titles. And you might say, well, those were lesser known titles anyway, but who's to say what is and what isn't? So for now, for as long as we can, I really am married to the idea of showing 35 as often as we can. And whether I can show it depends completely on how many copies they have and if it's available, honestly. But my whole idea was at least half the movies were to be on 35mm. And I will announce to you, because I think you'll appreciate this, we already have it's either going to be July or August. I might even wait till September, but we will be doing I'm so excited, 35mm 30-year anniversary screening of The Princess Bride. And we're going to have all kinds of awesome events built around that. So mark your calendar at some point in the next 3 months for that. I'm really excited about it. I've secured a 35 millimeter print. I just have to nail down. I really want to do it like right now, but July and August are always iffy. The movie technically didn't come out until September, so that's its technical 30th anniversary. And I just think I'm super excited. So that one's definitely coming up. And our musical, we've already picked. Every year I'm dedicated to doing one musical, at least one musical, one foreign film, and one film noir, because those are my favorite genres. So our musical is already picked out. It's going to be, appropriately enough, Singing in the Rain. We'll probably put that off until it's raining and we need a happy day. So that's kind of, that's what's coming up. And the other titles are still up in the air. I have a short list of 60 that I want to pick from. And then every year I had this other idea that I was going to theme it. Like every year we'll have an overall theme. And given what a fairly horrific year 2016 was for almost everybody in the world, I decided that this year's kickoff theme was going to be escape, in whatever way that meant. So we just finished our short run of Beauty and the Beast, which was a Jean Cocteau film from 1946, which is a beautiful film. We did To Kill a Mockingbird in conjunction with Perseverance. And we kicked it off with Sunset Boulevard, in which William Holden is trying to escape from many, many things. And, of course, you know, Gloria Swanson had escaped from reality. But so that's the idea.
So what's coming up next time for Gallery Walk?
First Friday. Well, for First Friday, I want to do this event with Terry Gallant and her Silver Screen Siren paintings and drawings. That's a lot to say. It'll open Friday. It'll run through the month. And I'm pretty sure we're going to hang all of them in the theater rather than in the lobby. I think it's going to be a more dramatic look if they're all in the theater. So you're going to have to actually come into the theater, which apparently is invisible from the road. So in case you don't know, it's across the street from City Hall, which nobody seems to know where that is either, unless it's 3 a.m. and you need a place to sleep. So that's right downtown there, the mural. We're right behind that.
And they have a website.
Oh, heck yeah. You kidding me? We have the best website in town. Not really. Gold Town Nick. GoldTownNick.com. Check it out. And and then all the usual nonsense that we're doing. We have a great film right now called The Lost City of Z, by James Gray, based on a best-selling novel by David Gann. It's an exciting real-life adventure about a gentleman who went exploring in Bolivia and discovered an ancient civilization. It's a terrific movie. We're playing it all this week and next week. And we're showing a scary movie. I'm so excited about that. We're showing this scary movie. We never get to show scary movies. So if you like scary movies, come down for It Comes at Night, which is in June sometime. And here's, I'm just psyched about this. It's the first time ever we are being allowed, which is a funny thing to say, but we're part of the national opening of the film on June 9th. I don't know how I qualified, but I'm pretty psyched about it. So.
All right, thanks for coming in.
You're welcome, Jeff. Thank you again.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 30th of May, 2017. The Lincoln Memorial was dedicated on this day in 1922. The architect Henry Bacon designed it to resemble the Parthenon. It has the Gettysburg Address on one wall, and on the other, the second inaugural address of Lincoln. There is a myth that the profile of Robert E. Lee appears in the locks of Lincoln's hair. The National Park Service says that is not true. It is true, however, that at the dedication in 1922, the audience was segregated, and the keynote speaker, Robert Moton, president of the Tuskegee Institute, an African American, was not allowed to sit on the speaker's platform. It was on this day, 1849, Henry David Thoreau published himself his own book, A Week on the Concord and Merrimack Rivers. It was his first book, an account of a two-week trip that he'd taken with his brother John 10 years before from Massachusetts to New Hampshire and back. The two brothers were very close. Henry was the introverted, studious one. John was more gregarious and fun-loving. John helped to pay his brother's tuition to Harvard. He helped Thoreau open his own school when he was fired from his teaching job because he objected to corporal punishment. A few years after their boat trip, John Thoreau died unexpectedly from tetanus. He died in his brother's arms, and Thoreau decided to seclude himself. He started building his cabin by the bank of Walden Pond, lived there for 2 years, and he completed the drafts of both A Week on the Concord and Merrimack Rivers and a series of lectures that would eventually become his classic Walden. Since the book A Week on the Concord and Merrimack Rivers was rejected, he was only able to publish it by paying for its printing from its sales. And 4 years later, after he paid off the printing debt, Thoreau wrote in his journal that his publisher had delivered the remaining unsold copies to his home. He said, "I have now a library of nearly 900 volumes, over 700 of which I wrote myself." Here's a poem for today by Ron Carlson, "Baby." "Oh, baby, I love you so much that I call you baby, even though you're 41 years old. Wait, I mean 42. But baby, oh, baby, you're my exhumation, my unmitigated intubation, my excoriating ablution, and the garnishment of all my mortal wages, my silver salver and my radish dish. There's some other stuff you are, baby, and only some of it has names. I've been exculpated by you for sure, and more than once, as you well know, for this is love in which we are amalgamated, nevermore to become visibly insinuated in our alloyship. Battlements will crumble, etc., baby, and whatnot, until infinity and infinity double meet at the corner of you and me streets in a town called, say, Hartburg or Hartsylvania or Babyville, because you're my baby, and probably if there was that town, you'd be mayor, baby, and baby, baby, you could appoint me poet laughing laureate." Poem by Ron Carlson, "Baby," from his collection Room Service, published by Red Hen Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity, brain training developed by scientists and game designers who turn cognitive research tasks into challenging games. Learn more at lumosity.com. And by Staples, with print and marketing solutions designed to promote businesses, including business cards, presentations, large banners, and posters printed in-store or ordered online. Learn more at Staples and Staples.com. Staples. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's 34 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned in to it in the afternoon. Our next guest in the studio is Steve Kosa, here to talk about the solstice, the total eclipse.
Well, thanks, Jeff. This is Steve. I am one of the volunteers in the Redirect Planetarium. And tonight at 7 p.m., we're going to do a show on the August 21st, 2017 total solar eclipse, which is the first solar eclipse that has hit the mainland USA since 1979. So what's going to happen? So August 21st, the Earth, the Moon, the Sun are going to line up. It's actually called a syzygy, which is probably a good Scrabble word, S-Y-Z-Y-G-Y. It means the Earth, the Moon, and the Sun are in a line, and the Moon's shadow will touch the Earth's surface in the western Pacific, and that shadow is only about 70 miles wide. It's going to start moving eastward, because the Moon's orbit around the Earth is actually faster than the Earth's movement around the Sun. So the shadow's moving around 3,000 miles an hour. When it approaches Oregon, it'll hit the Oregon beach just north of Lincoln, Oregon, and then it's going to move over the Cascades, and the shadow, 70 miles wide now, will be over Madras, Oregon, and that's where I plan to view the total solar eclipse, over Madras, Oregon. But the shadow will continue moving eastbound, and the shadow basically slows down in speed as the shadow becomes perpendicular to the Earth. And so the longest duration of the totality will be over southern Illinois. And the shadow will be moving about 1,500 miles an hour then. It slows down when the shadow is perpendicular. And the shadow will continue moving eastbound until it leaves the mainland USA at South Carolina. And then it will move over the Atlantic Ocean, and the shadow will leave the Earth's surface over the eastern Atlantic.
What do they call people who travel just to see eclipses?
Well, I'm actually one of them. I'm an eclipse chaser, so that's the normal term. I've been to 7 eclipses. Let me see if I can name them. There was an eclipse over Oregon in 79, then Mexico, then India, Bolivia, Venezuela, China, and Fiji, the 7 eclipses I've been to. And if I total the time under the moon's shadow of the 7 eclipses, I've been under the moon's shadow more than 30 minutes. This eclipse, August 21st, the longest duration of the eclipse will be over Illinois, about 2.5 minutes, where I'm going to view it in Oregon, Eastern Cascades, Madras, Oregon. The eclipse will be about 2 minutes and 10 seconds. And I'm viewing it there, even though the totality is shorter, because that has the best weather prospects of clear skies in Madras, Oregon.
And you get a t-shirt.
That's true. Yes. And also, I'll have my eclipse glasses to view the eclipse safely during the partial phases. But, of course, when it goes total, that's when you want to take your eclipse glasses off, because it's perfectly safe to look at the totally eclipsed sun, but not when it's even partial. That's when you want to use your filter or a pinhole camera or a projection lens for your binoculars or telescope to view it safely.
All right. Well, I hope you keep us informed of what's going on at the right time.
Well, that's what we're doing tonight, 7 p.m. tonight. Talk about it. And also, after we finish the talk on the eclipse, we'll be using the Spitz projector to look at the sky tonight here in Juneau.
Steve Kosis, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeff.
Strategically dipped below. Support for KTOO comes from Juneau Airport Shuttle, now providing service to and from the airport and three downtown locations, all flights every day. For more information and online booking, JuneauAirportShuttle.com.
Travel to Sitka this June and join us for the 46th annual Sitka Summer Music Festival. Grammy award-winning cellist Zool Bailey, the Ataka Quartet, soprano Kate Bass, pianist Natasha Peremski and Nava Perlman, and many other talented musicians will delight your senses with 24 concerts and community events. Tickets and full program details are available at sitkamusicfestival.org. Come to Sitka and experience Alaska's premier chamber music festival.
It's 43 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned into a June afternoon. I'm holding in my hands because I can barely lift it up. It's 6 pounds a book. It's called War Baby, The True Story of the Original Jeep, written by Will Spear. It was sitting right across from me. Thanks for coming, Bill.
Thanks for having me, Jeff. It's a pleasure to be here.
So this is it's about 400 pages, and it's 6 pounds. I haven't put it down.
Well, it passes the weight test. You're right.
Why did you do a book about Jeeps?
Well, it's really, in my opinion, it was probably one of the most elegant American industrial designs of the 20th century. And probably, it certainly always makes the top 10, if not one of the two or three most significant cars in American history. It was an enormous design breakthrough when it came out in 1940, and it really is a timeless design. I have a 1941 Bantam Jeep, which I drive around, and 76 years later, nobody sees it as an antique car. They see it as a Jeep, and it's just as good and does what it was designed to do just as well today.
What made you buy the Jeep in the first place?
Well, I got interested in cars, as all boys do, I guess, and I found myself with enough time to get into the hobby, and I was interested in it from a design standpoint, because I do make my living designing stuff, and I really have an interest in how cars look, and what attracted me were the Austins and Bantams of the 1930s, which were our first attempt at an economy car. They really should have been our Volkswagen, and I eventually became president of the club and edited the newsletter and took a car to Pebble Beach, of all things, for my first car show. But this company had invented the Jeep, and even the members of the club didn't really know very much about it. They had a very just a kind of a vague idea of what happened, and which turned out mostly to be wrong. And I started investigating into it. The web had just begun at that time, and so I actually found some of these very rare cars. There are probably 60 of them left running in the world. And by world, I mean world. They're all over the world. They're a highly prized, rare car.
About how many Jeeps were made in the course of their manufacture? They're still being made, I can imagine.
During the war, there are millions and millions of Jeeps, and they've been made by all kinds of companies, from Alfa Romeo and Delahaye to the most famous one that we know, or the World War II Jeep. But the type of car, the Jeep, as a design, was designed by the Bantam Car Company in Butler, Pennsylvania. And they made about 2,500 Jeeps. And but during the course of the war, between Ford and Willys, they split about equally 650,000 vehicles. And then after that, who knows? It's like in the millions. If you drive around town today, at least, you know, you'll see a lot of cars with the name Jeep on them. Whether they're really Jeeps or not, it'd be up to the reader to decide.
What makes a Jeep so special?
Well,
what design elements did they want to make sure they included?
Most people think that it was four-wheel drive, and that's what makes it so significant. And frankly, that's not at all what makes them significant, because four-wheel drive, in fact, the first four-wheel drive vehicle was in the 19th century. It was an electric car with an electric motor on each wheel. And by the time the Jeep was developed, even the Army required that any field vehicles had to be four-wheel drive. I conclude in my book that what makes the Jeep unique is its small size. very few people realize that the Jeep, original Jeep, was called a 4x4 quarter-ton truck, by which I mean its design was to carry a useful payload of 500 pounds. And it's actually almost, well, it's only a few inches bigger than a smart car on its wheelbase, and it weighs 50% less. It weighs 1,000 pounds less than a smart car. So to me, that was the design feature. I never see it as an invention. People say, who invented the Jeep? It's not an invention like the light bulb. It's a design. That is to say, it's an amalgam of existing elements which come together in a unique way. And it's just sort of it's just like a hit song, I guess. It's like it just has the right hook and the right meter to be a number one hit.
In popular science, I used to read when I was growing up, they used to sell Jeeps for $50.
They did. And the reason they did that is they made so many of them. The Willys Overland Company was at great pains to get the trade name of the name Jeep, which they got in 1948, because they thought there was going to be a great post-war market in this car, which never really did pan out. And part of the reason it didn't pan out was because of these ads. There were so many surplus Jeeps that it really saturated the market for that type of vehicle that somebody would want to go hunting or maybe for agricultural use or something like that. And so it's really, that's kind of what killed the market after the war, is that there were so many of them.
Were they really available for $50?
No, there aren't very many original ones that I know of at that price. And some people, I would have to add a few zeros on for any of the early prototypes.
Does it have three wheels at one point?
Does it have to be? Well,
I'm sorry. Does it have three wheels at one point?
Three wheels on the Jeep? No, mm-hmm. I don't recall that one. The motorcycle sidecar was what the Jeep kind of, everybody thinks that the Jeep replaced the horse. The horse had really kind of already been replaced in all except a few things, the reconnaissance type things. But the motorcycle was the big loser to the Jeep. As soon as the Jeep came out, they actually used the motorcycle money to make Jeeps. It was just so much more of a much better platform and not even that much bigger.
What was the most number of Jeeps per capita in the United States?
Oh, I have no idea, Jeff. My story kind of ends about 1941 or so, and so I never really followed up the commercial aspects of it. This is all kind of military and social history. It's a great story. The first part of it is kind of like Hoosiers. It's a little company makes big, wins the state tournament. It's a little tiny company with real long odds, and they create this vehicle, which is recognized immediately as a tactics-changing weapon of enormous significance. The second half of the book is more like a mini-series or Game of Thrones. All of a sudden, the little kid with the lunch shows up on the playground, and all the big kids form up packs to see who's going to get to eat the lunch. And you have all the big names in American history are directly involved in this thing, because in 1940 we weren't really in a war, and we had an army the size of I think it was like the 40th largest army in the world behind Romania at the time.
I'm talking to Will Spear. William Spear, he's made a book that came out recently, and it's about 400 pages long. How much research did you have to do to make a book that much?
I've been working on and off for about two decades on the research, but the last three years has been involved in the actual writing, layout, printing, production. It's a real book, and in the internet age, nobody makes these kind of things anymore, or not few people do, but this one is not even digitized printing. It's real offset printing and heavy paper and hardback, and it's a real book. And when I got through with it and I considered it. And then I went back into the internet and looked at Wikipedia and all the other sources. But the difference between the information you get there and the information you get in my book, it's a huge difference. So I think there's really a place for books if people will read them.
I'm talking with Bill Spears. The book is called War Baby, and it's about 400 pages long. Did you realize it was going to be that big when you first started putting it together?
Well, I kind of did, because it's because it is, on the surface anyway, a kind of an arcane subject. It's really kind of three or four books in one. And one, it's kind of a novel. It's kind of a, not in that it's fiction, but it reads like a novel, as they say. It's a work of scholarship in some sense. It's a coffee table book, lots of pictures in it, and some of them never been seen before. So I kind of knew it was going to be big, and that's why we kind of laid it out in a way so people can skip. If you're just interested in the story, you can kind of skip through it and pick those pieces up. If you're interested in a lot of the detail and pictures and where the headlights were and all that stuff, you can also do that. But I knew it would be big because it's just, there's a lot of detail and a lot of interesting ins and outs of the story and a lot of characters. One of the most interesting things I found about it is that in 1940, all of these people who were now household names of World War II generals were just colonels and majors. And the army was tiny. It was even smaller than the paper numbers. And so you have everybody from George Marshall to Bedell Smith to Dwight Eisenhower. All these guys are directly involved in the, you know, in the Jeep story. And on the civilian side, we have people like Harry Miller, who was our greatest automotive engineer, and the political side, you have this whole bunch of politicians. We've all heard of the Freedom's Forge or the Arsenal of Democracy and how remarkable it was that the United States had turned its economy into a wartime deal. But what people don't realize so much is that all of those billions of dollars went to just a very handful of companies and their subsidiaries, about eight companies. And small companies like the Bantam, they got crushed or their stuff stolen or they got absorbed. And so this is kind of the worm's eye view, the inductee, what it was like to be a small company. And these small companies produced some of the most remarkable and useful weapons of the war. Many generals say the Jeep was the best weapon of the war on either side, and that includes the atomic bomb. Higgins Boat Company did all the D-Day landing craft and stuff. They were a very similar small company that had to fight with the government to get recognition. So the military-industrial complex really did just almost take place during the events in this book. In 1939 and 40, the United States was one type of place, and in 1940 and 41 and on, we all of a sudden went into what we pride ourselves in calling modern times. I think times that are just now ending. And so, yeah.
It's a beautiful book. Tell me a little bit about the design process.
Well, I didn't know when I started. I had just years of research, and I never really intended to write a book this elaborate. I had been involved with Dave Hunsaker in a screenplay years ago about it, and I think it's still around somewhere, been optioned maybe. But since then, I just started working on it, and I was going to just make it into kind of a – I just wanted to get the research organized and – so that somebody would know what to do with it and where it all was. And so it was going to be kind of like a PhD thesis or something. And then I said, well, no. And before that, I'd written sort of a Seabiscuit type, reads like a novel deal, but I felt that was too unfair to the characters who I would have had to make up. Oh, it was a rainy day, and so was depressed, or something like that. It just didn't seem fair to the characters. So I have a friend in Italy who's also a Bantam Jeep guy, and he had written a book. He's 90-some years old, about the liberation of Bologna, and he had a guy, a layout guy, who's a wonderful layout artist. And he said, "Oh no, you can't do this, you know, because mine was just going to be like type pages, 150 pages long or something." He said, "No, this is going to be at the University of Bologna," and so he made me bite the bullet and lay it out in like a real book. So,
where can people see? We just got a minute left to go.
Well, the first place is support your local bookstore. Heritage has some copies down there, and then come up to our offices, which are the little cupola on South Franklin, the 174 South Franklin. We have them there. You can see there's a website, moorbaby.williamspear.com. You can get them on Amazon. But to see the book, go to Heritage or our place. That's probably the best place locally.
You're in your first Friday exhibit?
Yeah, we're going to have a signing on First Friday, and I'll just be there, and I'll be glad to sign your book anytime, but assuming you buy one, of course. But I'm going to, you know, for First Friday, we'll be up there and talking to people about it.
Bill Spear, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you, Jeff. It's a real pleasure.
Well, it's a beautiful book, and I hope you do well with it.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on Translators K27.